Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. As we enter the information age, the competition for low-cost labor no longer determines where things are made. Instead, it is proximity to markets. Joining us to discuss this and other changes are Laura Tyson, director at the Institute for Business and Social Impact at Berkeley's Haas School of Business, and she's joined by Susan Lund, who's a partner and leader of the McKinsey Global Institute. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. And now to the program.
I wanted to start, Susan, to ask you about the trade deficit. The news has been that it is much larger than ever in history. What does it look like today, and did it come as any kind of surprise to you?
Well, tonight's discussion is very topical. Today's Q4 trade numbers came out, and the U.S. trade deficit has grown to historic levels, higher than ever. We still run a surplus in services, but it's a surprise given the tariffs and given the policy goals of the U.S., although it's not a surprise to economists. So I think both Laura and I would agree that this is not surprising to economists, said that tariffs are not going to affect the bilateral trading patterns. It reflects a lot of different things, from decisions by companies to the value of the U.S. dollar. We also had very strong economic growth last year. So as the economy was growing and incomes were rising, Americans bought more imports. Yeah. But I think one of the interesting things about the figures is that it really illustrates what's going on with global value chains, because the types of goods that the U.S. put tariffs on from China were parts of these long, complicated supply chains that companies have created. And it's going to take time and a lot of investment for those patterns of supply chains to shift. The things that China put counter tariffs on the U.S. were agricultural goods and commodities, things like soybeans. Well, overnight, you can decide to buy soybeans from Brazil rather than the U.S. But it wouldn't be so easy, for instance, for Apple, as an example, to shift its production of iPhones from China to a different country. So that's part of what you saw, was a collapse in what we export. But a lot of the imports are going to be imported, you know, regardless of the price, because they're part of a larger product.
Okay. And you were nodding.
So just take the iPhone example. I mean, what economists said at the time is, well, you know, if you put all these tariffs on products that the U.S. is importing from China, many of those products are actually produced by U.S. firms operating in China, or by joint ventures between U.S. firms and Chinese firms operating in China. If you put tariffs on those things, the U.S. will have to continue to import them. There aren't a lot of alternative places to get these things from, like iPhones right now. You can't take the production facility down in someplace in China and move it overnight to someplace in Malaysia. So we said, so here's what's going to happen. Imports from China aren't going to go down very much, but the price is going to go up, so American consumers will actually be worse off. And exports to China will go down, because China will actually find a very targeted way, since they buy a lot of commodities from us, to say, oh, well, there are other suppliers in the world. So that's not to mention the fact that there were virtually no economists who believe that the trade imbalance itself is the result of unfair trading practices. The U.S. has a trade deficit with almost all of its trading partners. The trade imbalance is largely a reflection of the fact, and it saw very clearly in the last year, that the U.S. economy has been growing more rapidly than the rest of the world. We suck in imports from the rest of the world. That's an incentive of strength, not weakness. The dollar has been stronger, again, a sign of strength, not weakness. So you could say that the trade deficit, oftentimes an increase, reflects the strength of the U.S. economy, not the weakness. And that, to me, is, you know, the fundamental analysis of the trade imbalance that Trump has is just not correct. I'd like to get him in an introductory international economics class and try to explain this to him. But anyway, I never had him as a student.
It used to be that you heard in the popular press for the longest time that the biggest problem was that they had low wage labor, and that was sort of, and everybody was chasing those. The companies were chasing those low wage labor, and to the detriment of our own population. What does it look like now? Are wages a big part of what drives trade? What drives the supply chains? Tell us something about that.
That's a great question. That's really an outdated view of globalization and trade. So it was the case in the 1990s and 2000s, a lot of U.S. manufacturing work was offshored in search of lower cost labor. But today, that fundamentally is not what drives most trade flows. So our research found that only 18% of goods trade is actually from a low-wage country to a high-wage one, 18%. That is an astonishingly small share of trade, and it's declining. And the reason is automation technology. So with automation, labor is just not as big of an input. And so locating in a very low-wage country no longer makes a difference. You can now, with robots, Nike Flyknit shoes are made just over the border in Mexico. They're done mainly by machine, so the upper part is woven as one piece, and there's only two pieces in total, and it's attached to the sole. Adidas has a fully robotized production facility for athletic shoes. They opened up their Futurecraft factory, the first one in Germany, and the second one is in Atlanta. So increasingly, as goods are being made through automation, you don't need to produce it in a low-wage country. And instead, a lot of companies are thinking about other factors, like, is there a skilled labor force? What's the infrastructure and logistics like? What are energy costs? Because energy is a very important input. And the U.S., with the shale revolution and with natural gas and fracking, actually has very low energy costs. And they look at things like speed to market. So if any of you, I'm not sure anyone here shops at Zara, but there is a movement called fashion. Those of you with teenage daughters know all about fast fashion. So as soon as Kylie Jenner wears something, the next day it sells out globally. Well, to be able to respond to those types of trends, you can't have a good sitting on a ship for 30 days coming from Asia. You've got to produce close to where you want to get it into the stores. And so that's true in a whole host of different consumer goods. So a lot of different factors have come together that are causing companies to think more about speed to market and lots of factors beyond wages. And increasingly, wages are no longer the driving influence on where goods are going to be produced and where they're going to be traded.
And presumably technology is changing the whole equation when it comes to logistics. I mean, just the time it takes,
right.
Et cetera, the efficiency of it. What about geography? You talked about being close to market.
Yeah. So one of the things that we've seen is in just the last few years, say the last 4 years, there's been an uptick in regional trade. So for a long time, trade between regions was growing, and that was really trade between Asia and North America and Asia and Europe. Sure. And Europe and the U.S. And that gained share. But now, with some of these new factors, we've actually seen an uptick in the amount of trade that's taking place within a region. So that means within the EU, within Asia, and within North America. And that's consistent with this view that companies want to be closer to suppliers, that having an arm's-length supplier halfway around the world is costly, it's difficult to manage, you don't really know what they're doing. There could be a natural disaster, say in Japan, and suddenly the entire global automotive industry is disrupted because it turns out that one key battery component was made near the tsunami in Japan. Nobody realized this. So for a whole host of factors are meaning that now actually there are new networks of production being formed within regions, which is not to say that global trade agreements aren't important, But I think it is a different era of trade patterns, and that's great for countries like Mexico or Turkey and Morocco near Europe. But it does raise question marks for another whole set of low-income countries about what's going to be their source of advantage going forward.
Right. Right. Well, before we turn to that, I mean, you certainly, when you were in the Clinton administration, but also advising the Obama administration, Laura, you certainly anticipated this notion of, you know, finding trade agreements that really work for a region. Mm-hmm. And you think of NAFTA, right, which predated, but then was worked on by you as well. And of course, under the Obama administration, the Trans-Pacific Trade,
the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So was that a huge error to pull out of TTP?
So, again, I would have to say that I think my profession as economists from both sides of the political aisle think it was a big mistake, because we actually, it was a very interesting sort of approach we had, which was we recognized that trade was increasingly regional. We recognized that in the Asia-Pacific region, we were a central player there. A lot of the supply chains through that region are ultimately were established by a U.S. multinational company. So, mm-hmm. again, just to use the overused example of Apple, so much of the Apple phone produced in China actually comes from all over Asia, right. All over Asia. And what the Chinese do is they put it together and then they send it out. So we had this, we had a real presence. And we want, and trade was shifting, as Susan said. And so the idea of setting up some rules where it was very hard to get multilateral agreement, agreement at the WTO, but let's get some agreement on services trade, on an intellectual property trade, and on digital trade that would be new kinds of agreements given the growing role of these kinds of trade flows. Let's do it in Asia with our trading partners, and then let's do it excluding China, which will actually bring pressure on China to join in, because they because how can they be? Their entire export and import base is tied to that region, including the U.S. So this was both geopolitically motivated and sort of economically motivated, right? Right? Right. And to walk away from that agreement had both economic costs and also had geopolitical costs, because if you sort of think about China's going forward now, they have a trade agreement that they're leading in the region. The partners that we left behind unexpectedly in TPP have come together and said, well, we'll do this agreement. And now, you know, it turns out that some of what's in the, I don't even know the name of it, the new U.S. NAFTA, whatever it's called, mm-hmm. the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement.
USMCA.
Some of those pieces in that literally come as a direct read out of the TPP negotiations. Mm. A direct, this is, we'll just take what was negotiated there and we'll put it here because these were really good negotiations. They led to a really good outcome. So a tremendous lost opportunity, really lost opportunity.
Well, and to make it worse, the U.S. insisted on the digital chapter and intellectual property protections.
Yes, yes,
well, as soon as the U.S. left the deal, the other 11 countries said, great, we're setting those aside.
We're not doing
so
that.
So what they enacted actually didn't have the things that took months and years to negotiate that the U.S. wanted, and were very important given the reality of trade today.
So I also want to say, in general, if you look at the history of trade negotiations, sometimes a lot of economists would prefer that all trade negotiations be multilateral, because if you do it sort of regionally, what you're doing is you're biasing trade towards a region or away from other regions. But the truth is, sometimes the only way to get a complicated deal mm-hmm. is to start with a relatively small number of signatories. And if they're important enough, they actually will pull the rest of the world along. So that's why this lost opportunity in digital trade, if we had done that there, I really think that would have become a model for negotiations in the WTO and the next round of plurilateral decisions or multilateral global decisions.
What do you think are going to be, because what the Trump administration has done instead is a series of bilateral agreements.
Yes.
What
yes.
do you expect to come out of the talks with China?
you know, it is hard to tell right now. I think that basically one of the things that is going to happen here is that China can offer, and I think certainly by the pain that China has inflicted through its retaliation, China can offer real relief to the U.S. by committing to buy larger amounts of certain things. Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically soybeans. We will buy more soybeans. We will buy more anything
more
that's
energy.
Commodity-like. We will buy more of that. But I think at the end of the day, these really tougher issues about we would like the Chinese to basically say they will no longer have a pro-semiconductor industrial policy. They're not going to say that. In fact, they have a complete right to have a pro-semiconductor industrial policy. The U.S. had plenty in the history of economic development in the United States. Truthfully, the U.S. stole a lot of intellectual property from the Brits and basically used tariff protection in the U.S. to set up U.S. domestic industry. We did it. So China, we're not going to get them. This trade negotiation is not going to lead to any of the sort of significant changes in the structure of Chinese economic policy, which is what we wanted. I think at the end of the day, we're going to see we'll just have to continue the dialogue, which, of course, has been going on for a long time in the U.S.-China. We have had the Trump administration put it on hold, a U.S.-China strategic economic dialogue. And I would say in a slow process, we have had the Chinese make some small adjustments over time. So I think that's the most we can expect, is that we get some moves for them to commit to buy more products and some willingness to continue negotiating with us on the harder issues.
Mm-hmm. All right. Lee addressed the National Congress. What was important in what he said, and what was important in what he didn't say?
I think the Chinese are understandably quite committed to this notion of the next stage of economic development for them is to move into more of the technology industries. Look, I want to start with just a fact of aberration for China. China is a very large country. Most large countries, including the U.S., actually don't have high exports as a share of their output or high imports as a share of their output. They're actually pretty self-sufficient. They have large markets. They generate a lot of demand and a lot of supply. China chose a development strategy which really worked for them, and it was really quite distinctive in economic history, of saying, for a while, we will grow rapidly by bringing in a lot of foreign capital, by setting up, as I said, a lot of what they produce in China is produced with foreign-funded firms. We'll export to the rest of the world. We'll do some labor-intensive stuff as well. We'll do all that. And then when we get to the next stage of development, we can start doing a lot of this ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that is what they're doing. Yeah. And you would predict that. Now, the question is, are in doing that, some of the policies they pursue, as I said, are completely consistent with history and with the norms of international behavior. In the case of intellectual property, I think that is a serious issue. More U.S. firms are going after that issue in China, and more of the Chinese court system is going after that issue in China, but it's a very slow process. 2025, yeah, they have a vision to become as self-reliant as possible in technology industries. And I'll just say one other thing. The reason this is so complicated between the U.S. and China is not just economic competition. This is significantly a geopolitical mm-hmm. issue, because so much of the industries that they want to be self-sufficient in or even dominant in are militarily relevant. So we have here going on not just a shift in the relative economic positions of the U.S. and China, which I think is inevitable. I think it's inevitable. China is going to continue to grow faster. The U.S. will grow more slowly. China becomes a bigger weight in the global economy. Absolutely. I think there's no way to reverse that. And I don't think we should be interested in reversing it. That's, but geopolitically, there's the other issue. Okay, we're the Asia power right now. China is the rising Asia power. They have a different view of what that means geopolitically. And the same industries, semiconductor industry is really important for your iPhone. It's also really important for any kind of military technology you want to talk about. So that's why it's particularly complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. And going back to the economic angle, I mean, China is already moving up the value chain. So it started out in toys and shoes and, you know, cheap T-shirts. But already now you see its real focus is in automotive. It's in consumer electronics. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's starting to develop its own semiconductors for its version of the iPhone, the Xiaomi smartphone. So a lot of the goals in China 2025 are just the next step beyond. It's solar energy, it's aerospace, it's more artificial intelligence, semiconductors, but they have already shifted quite significantly away from just being the labor-intensive, low-tech assembler of cheap consumer products to making quite sophisticated goods. And this is something, by the way, we as economists have told China to do and should celebrate. I mean, I will point out that advanced economies now export $4 trillion worth of goods collectively to developing countries. So those new consumers in China, yes, they're going to buy a lot of Chinese-made products, but they're also buying a lot of potentially U.S. Mm-hmm. and European-made products as well. So it is a long-term opportunity for us.
Mm-hmm. In your report, you point out that one of the shifts is that we're seeing in the value chain is that we're moving away from the trading of goods and much more to services. Talk a little bit about that, because that also has meaning for your earlier point about labor.
Yeah, so a lot of the trade negotiations focus on tariffs on goods, and that traditionally is what was traded across borders, but increasingly it's services that matter. So when we look at services trade overall, it's growing 60% faster than goods trade. Mm-hmm. Goods trade is actually declining as a share of all the goods that are produced, and this is a structural shift we think will continue. Services like business services, IT services, intellectual property charges, telecoms, education. These things are now growing 2 to 3 times mm-hmm. as fast as goods trade. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, they don't get a lot of press. A lot of people don't focus on this, but this should be the heart of trade negotiations. And even in manufactured goods, services are an important component. So think about a car. Well, a lot of the value of a BMW or a Mercedes comes from the design and the engineering. Well, that's a service component that was added in Germany, embedded in the car that's then shipped around the world. Mm-hmm. Software is an increasingly important part of a car. So today it's only about 10 to 15% of the value of a car comes from its software, but by 2030, our automotive practice at McKinsey thinks it's going to be a third of the value of a car is going to be from the software that runs the car, not the tires and upholstery and so on. So this also gets overlooked. If you measure trade in that way, what creates value in products, you find that services are already 45% of the overall value of trade. Services are an area where the U.S. is a global leader. So we have, we talked about the trade deficit when we started, but I did not mention we have a very large trade surplus. We think it's mismeasured, that if you measured it appropriately, the U.S. would actually have a much, much larger trade surplus, but we don't want to get into national accounts here. but that's a piece of good news, and it's growing very rapidly. So that is an area where the U.S., if you say, like, what should we be negotiating with China? Well, it's opening up to services for mm-hmm. sure, because this is something that the U.S. Excels in and is very much the future.
But the underlying trends that you've been describing seem to all be in our favor, in the sense that we have in the past made good investment in technology. Mm-hmm. We are strong in service industries. We do have the ability to have a highly skilled labor force, both through immigration mm-hmm. and through training. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, who's up and who's down in the world in which?
You hit the nail on the head. And I actually wrote an op-ed in the Financial Times, I think last week it was published, that said exactly that countries like the U.S. and other advanced economies stand to benefit from all of the trends that we've been talking about, that we have the skilled workforce, we have the innovation ecosystems, we produce services, that production is likely to shift here, and we stand to gain. So now is exactly not the time that we want to be throwing up barriers, whether they're tariff barriers or other barriers. I mean, this is the moment, I think, that we're going to have tailwinds really boosting the position of the U.S. and other countries. And we can come back to those low-income countries that I mentioned earlier that are seeing their comparative advantage of low-cost labor becoming less and less important.
Laura, as long as I've known you, you've been an advocate for investment in technology, investment in innovation, and investment in education.
Right.
Is there a chance we could miss this boat? I mean, that we've got all this advantage going in, but that we could fail to fully capture it?
So I do think we need to worry seriously about all this. I do want to, in answering that question, I do want to underscore two things that, and then play off of that related to what Susan said. Number one is, there should not be a zero sum approach to this. To have a rising technological capability of the rest of the world, of Japan, of South Korea, of China, of Germany, of countries that actually are making breakthroughs in industries that are important to all of us, that should be viewed as a positive. So that's the first thing. The second thing I want to say is I really am worried, and we should get on to this, about the developing countries. Because I think this is actually, China is well positioned to move forward because they've gone through, as Susan said, phases of development already, which have them well positioned to pursue this going forward. The developed countries, and certainly the U.S., is very well positioned. The countries that relied upon, I'm going to follow a Chinese development strategy. I'm going to use low-cost labor and do shoes and apparel and toys and things that have low value added. That's going to be really, I don't think that pathway is necessarily open anymore, because so much of that can be done locally through automation. The labor cost advantage of shifting that around the world is just disappearing. So I think this is a real serious challenge for emerging market economies, and particularly for Africa. So now to go to the U.S., I think, look, if the competitive advantage of these industries and of countries depend upon continuing to invest in talent, in infrastructure, in R&D, I think one can look at U.S. investments in those areas and get worried. One can look at, so although the investment in research and development by U.S. companies is actually quite strong, the investment in basic science support by the federal government is significantly down. And we have to ask, and the budget request that Trump sent to the Congress, and they overrode him on this. They basically put in a much bigger number for R&D support than the president had requested. But there's always going to be the issue of trying to make sure that we have enough investment in basic science. And related to that, because they're very closely linked, is the talent pool that does the basic science. The engineers and scientists and technicians and mathematicians and engineers that you need. So I think that is an issue that the U.S. Are we investing enough? I don't think we are. Should we invest more? I think we should. I would like to see the U.S. at the federal government level have something like a capital budget. So when we look at the size of the budget deficit in the United States, and we say, oh, my God, it's headed towards $1 trillion, which is not good news, and not that I'm saying that it is, but actually companies and states, some states could say, okay, if you spend on an investment which has long-term returns, investment in basic science, and we know the returns to those investments are very high over time, or investments in infrastructure, that's a capital expenditure, and it's treated differently in the budget than just the ordinary operational expenditures.
The way you would treat it if you owned a building.
The long and short of this is if we lose in this competition, it will be on us. Okay, it will not be anyone else's fault that we lose. Okay, China's not going to make us lose. They're investing their own capabilities to build their own capabilities. Okay, we need to think about what we need to do here for us.
We've been hearing from economists Laura Tyson and Susan Lund on the changing nature of globalization and its impact on supply chains. After the break, join us for the second half of our conversation. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Laura Tyson, faculty director of the Institute for Business and Social Impact at Berkeley's Haas School of Business, and Susan Lund, partner and leader of the McKinsey Global Institute. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
A lot of this conversation has ended up coming back to the way in which the nature of work is changing. As you're looking at the industries, Susan, that will do very well going forward, the services industries, for example, and those that won't, what does it say for how we look at our workforce? I mean, if it's services, you care about the non-cognitive skills, right? And that's developed not in college. Mm. That's developed in the first couple of years, 2-3 years of life. Mm-hmm. Say something about the kind of investment we ought to be making there, and are we now?
Yeah. Well, a lot of my work life, when I'm not thinking about globalization and trade flows, I'm thinking about automation and the future of work. And it's just a fact that in a country like the United States, to be successful in the long term, you're going to need more than a high school education. We still have a large portion of this country that maybe doesn't finish high school or only finishes high school. I mean, that's just not going to be a path towards any kind of reasonable livelihood in an advanced economy. So there will be jobs, but people need to have, if not a college education, at least an associate's degree, some kind of technical school, or an apprenticeship. And I think that middle set of post-secondary education, but not college and university, is where the U.S. has really fallen down over the last couple decades. Our universities and colleges are among the best in the world. We do have a rising share of young people who go and get a degree, although a shocking number start college and then leave before they earn a degree. That's something we should address. But it's really this middle pool of technical skills. So to be many types of nursing, to learn to be a mechanic, to work in a factory. It's really to run the software that run the robots that make the goods, right? You need a mechatronics degree. So there are a whole set of professions where companies are constantly saying, we can't hire the talent we need. There are hundreds of thousands of open positions in manufacturing in this country right now because manufacturing companies are struggling to find people with, you know, this level of 2 years of, say, technical training. So the jobs are there, but this country really does need to invest in the human capital.
You seem to be saying, and Laura, I want to turn to you because you're an educator, you're a professor,
right.
That universities are not the only delivery system for that kind of education.
No,
so how should we think about certification? You can't apply for a job without putting the college you graduated from on that resume. What is a better way or another way to signal a skill set?
So I do think you're right to say right now that is the case, that a kind of the college degree is almost like a signal that you can be a committed, task-oriented, successful worker, okay, employee. But I do think there are a growing number of young people who are beginning to put together credentials. And you can, there are a growing number of ways to do that, online credentials. Sometimes I'm on the board of a big company, and the big company actually has developed a series of online nano degree programs. They are available to the employees of the company, but they're also available to anybody else who wants to take them. And you basically pay a fee and you take the course, and they're highly technical courses, by the way, and you complete the course and you have a credential. So you put together a series of credentials, and that becomes an entry point for you. So I do think this is a trend. I would still say that it's not the dominant trend, but I do think that it's promising as a way to find more alternative ways to achieve alternative kinds of education. But I also want to point out one other thing that's really important. It's not just educational opportunities, but if we think that people are likely, that the credentials you might get at one time may be quite relevant to that place that you live and that state of demand for your service, that over time, you may have to get new credentials, and you may have to be in another place. And this really does require a different kind of what I would call social insurance, because the risk to the individual the risk to the individual is, I get my credential, I go out and get a job, I lose the job because it's automated away or it moves to another location. I bear all the income loss, I bear all of the loss of benefits. I have no access. If I'm going to get new training, I'm the one that have to pay for it. That set of things, I think we're going to have to increasingly provide insurance to individuals so that when they go through these transitions, they have some support to do that. And that, of course, is, I think, what some of the more advanced European economies who are thinking about the same problems we're talking about right here, that's what they're putting into place. They're saying, let me think about what are the risks to the individual here as the technology and globalization are changing things on an annual basis, on a 5-year basis. What do I do to provide some help? Mm-hmm. And that is a kind of social insurance redefined, because it's a new kind of system and therefore a new kind of social insurance. I just want to add that. It's not education, but it's education with a set of policies to help people get the education when they need it. And that's important.
Right. And going back to universities, there's certainly been situations in the past where we will create public universities for the purpose of dealing with a transition in the economy.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that. Because now, I mean, university for many people is out of sight because of the sheer cost also.
Yes. So one of the ones that, you know, we don't remark upon a lot, and I think we probably should, so we live in the western part of the United States, there's something called the Western Governors Association University. And it's actually really good. and it has online programs, and the fees are very low. And hundreds of thousands of people now have been going through the this university. So basically, or if you think about, you know, another university that is actually is more widely recognized is, you know, Arizona State University. I mean, you know, really from any place in the world, not just any place in the United States, for a fairly low fee, you can get online degree in a very large number of alternatives. So I do think things are moving in this direction. Some public universities will be different. I mean, if you take, you know, I'm at the University of California, Berkeley. It has historically been and probably will continue to be a major research university. So it's playing a different role in the whole system. I don't think it's ever going to be developing large numbers of online undergraduate degree programs. It's not its role. But I know that there is a conversation going on at the level of the state now of should we have a community college online degree program available to everyone. So we would design the curriculum and it would. So I think that I'm optimistic. The technology can do an amazing amount at delivering very high quality education at very low cost. Mm-hmm. And that we have to make the investments to do that, but I'm optimistic that that's happening.
So. Let's go back to the developing world for a minute, because one of the great benefits of trade actually is that you can improve another guy's economy and that other guy becomes a big consumer of your products. You think about what NAFTA did to its contribution to the Mexican economy, and they're a big trading partner of ours, and it's in our interest to have that middle class grow. Where are you most worried? Laura pointed to Africa as a place we should be particularly concerned about. Where do you think the growth is going to be? Growth in middle class, we've seen it in China and India, and where do you think, you know, very targeted economic development efforts are needed?
Well, I'm also worried about Africa. I started out my career as a Peace Corps volunteer in West Africa. And I spend a fair amount of my professional life looking at the continent. And it is worrisome because, as Laura said, the development path that not only China took, but Japan, Korea, Taiwan, of developing this, you know, first you start with low-skill manufacturing, and then you move your way up. Well, that's coming to an end. So Vietnam and Bangladesh now have really ramped up their production of textiles and these labor-intensive exports. Some Chinese companies are setting up shop in Ethiopia, taking advantage of its extremely low labor costs. So there is some opportunity left, but that window is closing. And what's going to be the next great opportunity to lift thousands of people out of agriculture, raise their productivity, give them higher wages? And there's a big question mark. We really just don't know what that path could be. Now, there's services trade. We know that Costa Rica, the Philippines, India have developed expertise in providing call centers and IT support services and all sorts of what we call back office processing. A lot of it is data entry, accounting, HR kind of stuff at very low wages. And that's been successful for them. But all those things are highly automatable. So they're going to have to continue to provide more sophisticated types of back office services if that's going to be relevant. There could be opportunities. We talk about technology leapfrogging. So in Africa, they never really built out landline telephones. They've sort of jumped to mobile phones because they didn't have the infrastructure. And that's worked out very well. Now we're seeing the same thing with what we call mobile banking or digital finance. So China's actually a world leader, but so is Kenya. Developed M-Pesa, this mobile money account where you don't even need a smartphone, just an old flip phone, and you can transfer money between people or between family members on your phone. And right now, 80% of Kenyan adults use M-Pesa to pay their bills and so on. So far beyond the U.S., we're still carrying around wallets filled with cash and we write checks and checkbooks, right? This incredibly archaic system. So digital finance. Now we have digital IDs. We can look at online work platforms. So there are websites like Upwork, where a company posts a task. It might be editing a document, writing computer code, designing a website, and workers all over the world will compete to do that work. And a lot of those workers happen to be in India or Kenya. So maybe that will create opportunities at scale. So there are good ideas, but there's not, it's an unknown. And it's frightening because in addition to having to build out the roads and ports and airports, which they haven't done, and getting good business regulations and a competitive landscape that has a fair playing field, which they haven't done, now they need to get wireless access, and they need high-speed internet at affordable costs, and they have this new digital infrastructure that also is yet another demand on countries that just don't have a lot to start with. So I do worry, and I don't think we know what the future is going to hold.
And of course, cell phones have been a way to engage in economic activity, but also to advance education, to advance deliver health care. True. It's a pretty wide range. And I guess my question for both of you is, what is the interest of a a Cisco, of our companies in kind of building that infrastructure? Or, more of a, what is it, Google's loon, the balloon
approach? Exactly. Yeah. Google and Facebook are trying to bring internet access to the rest of the world. It's interesting because Facebook in India bundled it with some of their products, and India said, no, thank you. But there, I think there are many groups, philanthropic as well as private companies, who are trying to bridge what we call the digital divide. But it's, like I said, it's just another thing, a challenge for these countries to meet.
The degree to which there's sort of a sense that, well, the government's on it when it comes to investments in AI and in ensuring that the benefits are felt, and are having a little sort of less sense of certainty that anyone's in charge, and whether there is, maybe in charge is the wrong way to put it, but that there is a plan in place that will benefit us all. What do you think is underlying that? And what I'm told, by folks who work for Edelman, is that the rise was because of a rise in trust in private sector in China.
Well, I would say, look, it doesn't help that we've now been living through a couple years of incredible partisan divisiveness. I live in Washington, D.C., so I have a front row seat. And we have elected officials questioning the intelligence service, the Justice Department. I mean, the rule of law and the institutions that we've built are under attack, really from all sides, from the right and the left, right? So it does not actually surprise me that all this has filtered through to Americans. The Chinese system, think what you want, doesn't have dissent. It doesn't have public divisiveness. It has had an extraordinary period of this economic growth that the world has never seen. And so the average person is doing much better off than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, than their parents, right? And so they're feeling pretty good about the world. I think that's where I think the results didn't surprise me. Now, I don't think it's good, and I think that in the U.S., we need to work on rebuilding trust in some basic institutions and some rules of the road by which we're all going to comply. But I think that, given what we're going through, it's not surprising.
Yeah, and where the angst is in democracies generally. So
that's right. Yeah. I think I think we should also remember that 2007 isn't that long ago. So 2007 to 2011, 12, they were really, really awful years for most people, most of middle class and lower income workers in the advanced industrial countries. There was a great recession. That was when a lot of jobs got lost. They haven't come back. Most people still, to this day in the United States, since most of the wealth that people have is in the value of their property, and that has not been completely restored even now.
Right.
So you can see why people began to say, this just is not working.
It's not working for
me. It is not working. And China navigated through that process very well. I mean, they actually did, I would like to say, traditional, if it's as if John Maynard Keynes told them what to do, which is just spend a lot of money on infrastructure. Just keep spending money and employing people. And the U.S. and the advanced industrial countries in Europe decided not to do that. They decided, no, we'll fight the debt. And China said, no, we're not fighting the debt. We're going to keep growing. We're going to keep people employed. We're going to create incomes. So you can see how people would sort of say, if you're in China, boy, this really worked. And if you're sitting in Spain or Greece or the decimated parts of the United States, you're saying, this didn't work. Why should I trust these officials? I don't trust these officials.
Please comment on new economics and the notion that growing government debt doesn't matter. Is there an impact on the dollar, which affects trade?
Okay, so I think, I definitely think that there's an effect on trade, because I think that in a simple way, if the growing government debt, if what we, I would focus on the deficit which feeds into the debt. So here's the debt, and every year if you run a deficit, you're just increasing the debt. So let's look at the deficit. The deficit at the national level measures how much you're spending versus how much you're producing. So if you're running large deficits, it means you're going to be spending a lot on things not produced in your country. So that part of what we saw today in the trade numbers with China is we were growing rapidly. We have a big deficit this year. We were stimulating demand. The demand couldn't be met by all the things that are produced here. People bought from the rest of the world. So I do think there's always going to be a link between the size of the trade deficit and the size of the overall deficit. Yes. Now, the issue of this new monetary theory, which is say, I think we want to put it in context. The government debt doesn't matter as long as the interest rates on the government debt are as low as they are, and as long as the private sector is willing to buy government debt at this interest rate, okay? So basically what's happening is the rest of the world is saying, yeah, we like to actually hold U.S. government securities, and we're willing to hold them even when the return on them, inflation adjusted, is pretty much zero. There's no return. The rate of return, once you take into account inflation, is virtually nothing, but people seem to want to hold them. So that means the U.S. government is getting the ability to run up its debt. Now, that is true right now. It may not be true some years from now. We don't know when that will change. But suppose it does change, then what's going to happen here is that the interest rates will go up a lot, or what the monetarists, what the new monetary theory types would say, well, no, then the Federal Reserve can come in and buy the debt. Well, if that happens, you have to think about something we don't think about anymore, inflation. We don't think about it. We think it's like all gone. It's never going to happen again. A lot of the history of monetary and fiscal policy has been volatility in inflation rates and what happens to real interest rates. So we're now making this new theory up after decades of the interest rate coming down, could go up in the future, and decades in which the inflation rate has come down, could go up in the future. So it's a very, you just have to take into account that right now, it may very well be the case that the increments in the U.S. government debt don't matter very much. Right now, that's probably correct. But I do think you're setting up a kind of possibility for the future, and this is about future generations too. It's just like with the climate. I mean, you're setting up things that may have to be dealt with by the future in different circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Let me add, look, I think, first of all, I don't think it is a very coherent theory quite yet, but to the extent, I think it's useful to say not every deficit or government debt is bad and scary.
Nope.
In my mind, it depends a lot on what it's spent on. So we talked earlier about the need for the U.S. to invest in infrastructure, which we didn't do, to increase public spending in R&D. Federal government spending in R&D has drifted downwards. We need more investment in affordable education and different types of post-secondary education. So there are a lot of good things that we could be using deficit spending to fund in this era where interest rates are lower than the growth rate.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're not doing that. We just had a giant tax cut. The U.S. is now taking in. So, you know, we talk about, say, Ireland is this has very low corporate taxes, and that's why companies are setting up shop in Ireland, right? Ireland's government takes in a good 4 to 5% of GDP more in tax revenue than the U.S. It has a very low corporate tax, but it has a VAT, a value-added tax worth, you might know this, I don't know, 18% or 15% on every single item bought, right? So overall, that government has got 4 to 5% of GDP more to spend. A problem with the U.S. right now, in my view, is just that we don't take in enough money. We take in a very small portion of the economy as taxes, and so we can't fund the infrastructure and the education and the R&D and so on. So at this point in time, we're running, we ran up a large deficit in debt, but we aren't spending it on the long-term investment priorities that I would think are important.
Yeah. And that's why I mentioned earlier capital budget. That's why I think we could get clarity about this if we said, okay, here's the amount of a deficit. Here's the debt we're accumulating. Here's the amount of that deficit, which is being invested in these things which have long-run returns. We can actually measure those returns. We have pretty good evidence of what they would be. And then you can measure the returns going out 10 or 15 or even 20 years relative to the cost of continuing to service that debt, which is actually pretty low because the interest rates are so low. So we could get much more clarity on this. And I just want to say, Susan's point about value-added tax is very important because I think in this election process, we're going to hear a lot about significant increases in various kinds of programs, which I actually support. I was talking about social insurance before, and so I do support more spending on those kinds of programs. And then we'll point to other countries that have them. They tend to have much higher percentages of their economy being collected in taxes and then redistributed in terms of the social insurance program. So they bring in more revenue and they push it out. It's not more investment, it's more of these existing, these social welfare and social insurance programs. And I'm afraid in the U.S. we're going to get, instead what we're going to do is going to say, we want all those programs and the deficit doesn't matter and the debt doesn't matter. And we have this whole new theory which is just based on the historical moment of low interest rates and low inflation. We're going to have this whole new theory which says, oh, don't worry about that. But that's just wrong. It's not right. But the theory will be used to say we can do all of this without worrying about the revenue base, and that's not right.
Please join me in thanking Laura and Susan.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Laura Tyson of UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business and Susan Lund, partner and leader of the McKinsey Global Institute. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.